Good morning, everybody. I think I spoiled you. You have to bring commotion. You have to bring commotion. I mean, if I hand out a sheet to you, it's only as an addition to the chumash, but you have to have a chumash. And the fact is that the only reason why I made up these sheets for you, this, and I did it early this morning, in the wee hours of this morning, because I thought that you just feel funny without a sheet. But we could do the whole sheet without a sheet. Yeah, but you know, I've simply spoiled you. We have to unspoil you. All right. This week's parsha is Parshat Bahalotcha. Now, while I may have said very often about every parsha in Torah that it's a fascinating parsha, the most fascinating one of them all is Bahalotcha. The most fascinating one of them all is Bahalotcha. And when I say it about some other parsha like Hazinu or Zot HaBracha, don't come back with me. Come back at me and tell me what you said that about Bahalotcha. In its own way, we're talking about a sedra that is light and darkness. We're talking about a sedra that takes Klal Yisrael to a peak, and from that peak begins a descent into near oblivion. We're talking about two parts of a sedra that for all intents and purposes sort of somewhere in the middle, everything changes so radically and so dramatically. From great exhilaration begins a process of absolute tragedy, a tragedy from which we suffer ad hayom hazeh until today. A sedra that begins with such absolutely great expectations and hopes and plans for the future becomes bogged down we're going to have to see what it becomes bogged down in. We're going to have to see where Israel is going to fall, and that descent is going to continue into Parshat Shlach, and therefore it's a tragic sedra. From the beginning of the sedra, really, until someplace toward the middle, and we'll take you, we're going to read a little bit in the sedra. We'll start reading chapter 10, Pasuk 35, right before chapter 11. But let me tell you first, in broad outline, what's going on in the sedra. What happens in the first half of the sedra is that which has begun at the outset of Bamidbar. At the outset of Sefer Bamidbar, the Jewish people are counted. They are divided into the various camps. There are four separate and distinct groups of tribes around the Levim. The Levim are around the Mishkan, taking care of the Mishkan are the Kohanim. They are given precise instructions who is to do what at the moment that the camp has to travel. The three families of the Levi, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari, each one has their specific task. Everything is figured out precisely to the moment. And in this sedra, in Bahalotcha itself, well, first of all, there is the command to light the menorah, which is already an indication that we're talking about a journey that is going to bring light to the Jewish people. The tribe of Levi are separated and sanctified and made holy. And then instructions are given to Moshe that he is to make unto himself trumpets, and these trumpets are going to be used to call the leaders of the community together. The trumpets are going to be used in order to call the people together when Moshe has to speak to them. The trumpets are also going to be called to signal the beginning of the march of the camp. There's a whole parsha also that tells us about the cloud of glory that was over them all day and the cloud of fire at night, and that was the first signal that they are to journey, and that there are times that the cloud would lift itself and the entire camp would begin the process of packing and getting ready to move. They'd move for a day, they'd move for a week, sometimes months, and then the cloud would come down and descend, the whole camp would settle in. And we're talking about a people that ultimately, what they have prepared themselves for is they're on the way to Eretz Yisrael. This is the journey. And Moshe turns to his father-in-law, and just you can hear the way he's talked to his father-in-law. That's a few psukim earlier in chapter 10. Let's start there. Chapter 10, Pasuk 29, Vayomer Moshe Lechovav ben Reuel Hamidyani. Pasuk 29, chapter 10. Moshe said to Chovav, the son of Reuel, the Midyani, Chotein Moshe, the father-in-law of Moshe, Nosim Anachnu El Hamakom Asher Omar Hashem. We are journeying to the place that God has said, Oto Eten Lachem, I'm going to give that place to you. Lechoyitanu, come along with us. Ve'hitavnu Lach, and we will be good to you. Ki Hashem Diber Tov HaYisrael, because God has spoken good about Israel. Do you hear? We're journeying, we're going, come along. This is the great historic journey to Eretz Yisrael. Vayomer Elav, his father-in-law, said to him, Lo Eileich, I won't go. Ki im el arzi ve'el moladati Eileich, I'm going to go back to my land and to my birthplace. Vayomer. Moshe said to him, Al no tardovo tanu, please don't forsake us. Ki al ken yodato chanoteinu b'midbar, because you knew where we encamped in the desert. Vayitalanu le'einayim, you will be eyes for us. You have been so helpful. You have been a source of great inspiration to us. And he tells Moshe, tells his father-in-law, you will go with us. From that good which God is going to give us, we will share that good with you. Rashi brings the Gemara that says that they gave the family of Yitro Doshna Shel Yericho. Doshna Shel Yericho, the luscious area around Yericho. Later on in Tanakh we find that the children of Yitro live in the area of Yericho. And now the journey begins. By Yisum Ehar Hashem Derev Shloshe Yomim, they journey from the mountain of God. They had been at the mountain of God for over a year, had received Torah there. And now the journey begins, a journey of 3 days. Vadon Brit Hashem, no sail of name, and the Ark of the Covenant of God is traveling before them. Derev Shloshe Yomim, 3 days journey ahead, Latur Lahem Menucha, to find for them a place where they can really rest. And the cloud of God is upon them during the day as they journey from the camp. We are watching now a people with a destiny, with a goal, with an objective. God is leading them to the promised land. This is what they've been waiting for all of this time. And we're talking of that there must be flags unfurled, and there are trumpets that are blowing, and people are marching, and horsemen are riding. I tell you, we're talking about a cast of millions that are on their way to the to Eretz Yisrael. And then, of course, comes the great prayer by even Soah Aharon. And when the ark journeyed by Yom Moshe, Moshe said, Kuma Hashem, arise, O God, your fruits, or your vech, or your enemies should be dispersed. Your nusu nisan echo mi panecho, and those who hate you shall flee from before you. This is the great prayer. Klal Yisrael is going out to war. Let the enemy be dispersed, and those who hate you flee from before you. And of course, the beautiful Rashi that we've commented on a number of times. Your nusu nisan echo mi panecho, those who hate you shall flee from before you. What do you mean? Those who hate God? Are we talking about those who hate God or those who hate Jews? Are these anti-Semites or anti-God? Says Rashi, whoever hates the Jewish people despises God and works the other way. As far as the Rabbeinu Shlomo, as far as God is concerned, whoever hates the Jewish people, God sees it as one who hates him. And then Uvenucha Yoma, when they came to rest, Shuvah Hashem Livavot Alfei Yisrael, God brings together the tens of thousands and the thousands of Israel. And of course, here is these are the two psukim, which are the parsha of Ayib and Soah. For those of you who have Chumashim, you may very well see that before the pasuk of Ayib and Soah and after the pasuk of Uvenucha Yoma, there are upside down nuns. In a Sefer Torah, there are nunin hafuchin, upside down nuns. We're not going to talk about that at great length now, except for, of course, the fact that Chazal say this is not the place of this parsha. It was put here for other reasons. The approach that we're going to take today is that the Vayehi ben Soah and the Uvunucha Yomar seem to be surrounded, bracketed by these nuns, because, well, what was it that Moshe had told his father-in-law? Nosim anachnu, we are journeying, we're going, we're on the way. This is the great march to Eretz Yisrael, but something's going to happen that the nosim, the journey, is going to turn backwards. Something is going to happen. The nun of travel is going to be upside down. Things are going to be turned upside down. It's going to be topsy-turvy. And here begins the profound tragedy, and we're going to have to study the tragedy, and we're going to have to see if there is any contemporary significance. And of course, we know that for every parsha in Torah, there's always great contemporary significance. And what I'm going to be using is something I never said, and I don't know, all of a sudden I decided, you know, I want to put in a few good hours studying this, a shir from Rav Soloveitchik that we never ever discussed here, and we're going to do it today. In addition to here and there, I think that I succeeded in coming up with a few ideas. We'll see. Come again. Vayehi ha'om kimit oninim, and the people were like complainers. Ra ba'ozne Hashem, it was evil in the ears of God. Vayishma Hashem, God heard. Vayichar apo, and his anger was kindled against them. Vativar bom eish Hashem, and the fire of God burned against them. Vatochal b'kitzei ha'machaneh, and it consumed the edges of the camp. All of a sudden, in one pasuk, we've gone from the triumphant march toward Eretz Yisrael, and Rashi had pointed out that really it was a 3-day journey. The Rebbe Sham was hurrying the journey in order to get them into Eretz Yisrael even quicker. And all of a sudden, something's happening. The pasuk doesn't even tell us what it was. Complaining. What are they complaining about? What are they complaining about? Doesn't say what they're complaining about. It seems that Moshe himself doesn't even know about this, because the pasuk said the people were kid mitonanim, like complainers. It's evil ba'aznei Hashem, in the ears of God. He hears. Moshe doesn't hear. Moshe doesn't know. Nobody's talking. But there is some sense of discontent and unhappiness. By Yishma Hashem, God heard, and he got angry. And the a fire begins to consume, pushing death, destruction. Vayitzak ha'amel Moshe, the people cried out to Moshe, vayitzpalel Moshe al Hashem, and Moshe prayed to God, vatishka ha'esh. And the fire receded, went out. Vayikra Hashem amok ma'hu tav eira, and he called the name of that place tav eira, ki bo adrabon eish Hashem, because the fire of God burned against them. We're not finished yet. It's going to go from bad that we don't even understand what it is that has happened. And we go to Asafsuf Asher Bekirbo his Abu Ta'ava. Asafsuf already is a description of who it is, that is making the problem. In the Mit Oninim, we don't really know yet who it was, and we don't know what it was that they were complaining about, but now it becomes more specific. For Ha'asafsuf, the rabble, the mob. Rotten rabble? Yeah, you like that word? All right. Says Rashi, Elu Edev Rav, the multitude of peoples who had joined the Jewish people when they came out of Egypt. Shenefu aleim v'tzeitem Mitzrayim, who gathered around the Jewish people when they went out of Egypt, so that Asatsuf, Rashi is also explaining where the word Asatsuf comes from. Asat, those who gathered around. Those who gathered around. Those who got onto the bandwagon and marched out of Mitzrayim with the Jewish people. Camp followers. But now camp followers has a very specific meaning. This is not, no, I must reject that in favor of rabble. Okay. The Asatsuf Hashem Bekirbel, the Asatsuf who are in the midst of Uta Avam, they desired. There was a lust. By Yoshuvu, they turned. By Yisku. By Yisku Gam Bnei Yisrael. Now you understand, it begins with the Asatsuf, with the Eid of Rav, but it has affected the children of Israel. They're also crying. They're on their way to Eretz Yisrael, to the promised land. And they're crying. They haven't even begun to suffer the problems of Aliyah yet. This is the flight there. And they sit down and they cry. Vayomru, and they said, Mi ya'achileinu basar. Who's going to give us meat? This is so strange. No, what are you talking about? You have a few days march till Eretz Yisrael. You're on a great mission. You're a great mission. I mean, so you won't have a steak with French fries. What's going on? And they're crying for flesh. I mean, obviously there's a great deal more that's happening here than we are being told of yet. And then listen to the statement. Zacharnu es hadaga asher nochal b'mitzrayim chinam. We remember the fish that we ate in Mitzrayim free, chinam. You understand? A year later, they are nostalgic for the sights, the sounds, the smells of Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim! We remember that. Et hakishuim, the cucumbers, et havatichim, and the watermelons, and the chatzir, and the leek, and the habesalim, and the onions, and the hashumim, and the garlic. It's unbelievable. I mean, even if all of these things are that great, I mean, I can imagine somebody lusting for a steak. For a steak at Kosher Delight in Borough Park, it is something to it. I mean, that is one of the great pleasures of this world. But we can do without it. We can do without it, especially since we have Nathan and King George. We don't need to. We can do without it. But here we're talking about a selective memory. This is a memory that they don't remember the suffering, the pain, Jewish children thrown into the Nile, being beaten, being enslaved, no day, no night, nothing. But they remember the cucumbers. Va'ata nafshenu yevesha ein kol, our souls are dry. There's nothing. Bilti al amana inenu. And the only thing we can look forward to is the mud. And I don't know, like, Rashi sometimes just captures the meaning of a phrase. Bilti al amon einenu, our eyes are only toward the mon. Mon ba'shachar, mon ba'erev. Four words Rashi says. Mon in the morning and mon in the evening. Just to leave the impression it's so, so boring. We're talking about a mon that most probably was the best food that God had ever created for man. I'm sure there were no problems with cholesterol and with oil and with fat. You didn't have to work it off. It was the healthiest thing that man ever ate. And you could have every time that you wanted it. And they're complaining about the mon. They want basar. They want basar. And they want garlic. And they want leek. But now comes a parenthetic comment of the Torah, where the Torah describes us or reminds us what the mon really was. Don't be left with the impression as though the mon was just about the most boring and unappetizing food. The mon kizrar godhu, it was like coriander seed. Ve'eno ke'en habidolach, and there was a brilliance, a shine from it like crystal. There was something so beautiful about it. Shotu ha'om v'lachu, the people would spread out and carry the tochanu, and you could do whatever you wanted with it. You could tochanu v'rechayim, you can grind it by dochol v'meducha, or with a mortar and pestle, you can grind ubishlu bakoro or cook it in a pot. But also otovu got, you can make it cakes, you can have mon cakes, you can have anything you wanted. V'hayatamu ketam l'shad hashemen, and the taste was like honey. And by the way, it doesn't mean that they have to do those things. All you have to do is think about it, and it happens. You don't have to do anything. And when dew would come down upon the camp at night, yated hamon alav, the mon came down upon the dew. In other words, the mon didn't just come down upon the sand of the desert. So here were three psukim that were just put in over here by the Rebbe. You should not, when they're complaining about mon, you have to know that mon was the most magnificent kind of food product. By Yishma Moshe, as Ha'am Bochelamish Bechotav, and Moshe heard the people crying by families, an important word here. Ish lepetach o'alo, each one at the door of his tent, by Yichar af Hashem Ma'od, and God got very angry, ube'enei Moshe ra, and in the eyes of Moshe, this was bad. Here already Moshe too hears. By the Nitzonim, it was only evil in the ears of God, only God heard. That was a silent kind of discontent, sort of people walking around with complaints that keeping to themselves. That's the worst time. In a certain sense, this second complaint, though it's of course ugly and shameful, who's going to give us basa? Who's going to give us flesh? Who's going to give us flesh? By the way, you'll see that when that error that I just made, who will give us flesh, was not such a terrible error. Flesh, meaning, yes, a steak, but it also means flesh, and we'll see that soon. And they're all crying. You understand, the people who are marching on the greatest march that any people have done in history, from the veins, by Yom Moshe Hashem. Now here what's important is Moshe's response. We're going to have to see how Moshe responds and how he reacts, and how God is going to respond and going to react. And then we're going to have to ask why this response and why this reaction, because Moshe here is going to respond in a way that he never responded to any other challenge in the desert. And there were many. Watch how he responds. Vayomer Moshe l'Hashem, Moshe said to God, Lama hare ota la'avdecha, why were you that bad to your servant? V'lama lo matzati chen beinecha, why didn't I find favor in your eyes? In what way has God been bad to him? Lo sumech masa kol ha'am hazeh alive, to place the burden of this whole people upon me? Ha'enoshi haditi et kol ha'am hazeh, am I the one that was pregnant? I gave birth. Imanochi elidetu, did I give birth to this people? Did I carry them? Ki komare lai, did you say to me, so'ehu v'chekecha, carry him in your bosom, kasher yisoha omeinat hayonek, like a nurse carries a baby. Al ha'adoma ashen izbatol avokav, to the land that you swore to give to his fathers. What do you think I am? Why have you been this bad to me? What have you done? Me'ayin li bosa, where do I have to give to this entire people? That they cry to me saying, give us meat that we will eat. I alone cannot, I cannot carry this entire people. It's too heavy for me. I can't do it. Impossible. Now listen to this puzzle. Most frightening of all. God said, Moshe says to God, if this is what you do to me, hargeini naharot, kill me, please kill me. If I found favor in your eyes, kill me. I shouldn't see the evil that's going to be born. Well, the problem over here is problem number one. And this is the one that we have to begin to deal with. Is this the way Moshe Rabbeinu responded to other challenges? How does Moshe Rabbeinu respond when God tells him that the Jewish people have made the ego, the golden calf? Now you understand, the golden calf is a sin. No more than 40 days after they had been witnesses to the greatest experience in all of history, they saw the divine presence itself come down upon Mount Sinai and say to them, Anochi, I am Hashem Lekech, I'm God, your God, who took you out of Egypt. 40 days later, they're dancing around the golden calf, saying, Ela Elohecho Yisrael, this is your God Israel that took you out of Egypt. God tells this to Moshe. How does Moshe react and how does he respond? Oh, does he respond? He responds with defiance. He is forceful. He is resolute. He doesn't panic. He petitions God. And it makes it quite clear to God. The first thing he does is, Vayechal Moshe Pnei Hashem Elokav. Moshe prays before God. And he says, you must forgive these people. You must forgive these people. And that prayer was an extremely, extremely thoughtful. Number one is the pasuk. God says to Moshe, if up in heaven, after the Jews have made the golden calf, God, this is God speaking to Moshe, V'ata now hanicha, leave me. V'ichar api b'hem v'achalein. And my anger will burn against them and I will destroy them. V'e'ezeh otcha l'goy gadol. And I'm going to make you into a great people. Do you know what it sounds like? And we're going to see that in number three. Take a look at number three. V'ata hanicha li. God is saying to Moshe, leave me. Do you know what it sounds like? As though Moshe Rabbeinu is holding God, making it impossible for him to do anything. And God seems to be pleading with Moshe, no, leave me be and I'll destroy them and I'll make you into a great people. Number three, V'ato Hanicholi, Om Rabbi Avu said, Il Mole Mikra Kotu. If there would not be a pasuk that said it, we couldn't have said it on our own. If the Torah wouldn't have written it, we couldn't have said it. Milami, you know what the pasuk comes to teach us? Shetovso Moshe HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Shetkodom, Shetofes, Shetkavedo, Bigdo, V'amal upon him. It means that Moshe, what the pasuk is saying is that Moshe grabbed God like a man grabs somebody else by his clothing, and he said to him, Ripei Shalelam, I'm not going to leave you until you forgive and atone for the Jewish people. Defiance. He is defiant not only to Klal Yisrael, but to God himself. And when God says, I'm going to make you into a great people, so what does Moshe Rabbeinu later tell them about Yisraelam? You had better forgive them. V'im ayin, and if not, erase me from the book that you wrote. Does Moshe panic? Does Moshe begin to turn to God and say, why did you place such a terrible burden upon me? How can I carry a people like this 40 days after revelation at Mount Sinai? They're dancing around the ego. Here I am up in heaven and I'm getting the two Luchot HaBrit, and look what's going on down there below. No. Moshe Rabbeinu is resolute, he's strong, he's defiant, he's powerful, he prays with great eloquence and with force. And when he comes down from the mountain, he acts resolutely as well, smashes the luchos, calls upon the tribe of Levi to go through the camp and destroy anybody who worships the Egel. He acts like a leader. He acts like a manhig Yisrael. Vayechal Moshe. Vayechal Moshe et Pnei Hashem Elokav. So the translation is that he prayed before God. But why is the word Vayechal used? Why doesn't it say Vayitpalel or Vayitchanein? Vayechal seems to leave the impression that this is a prayer unlike any other prayer. Like he is petitioning God, and Rabbeinu Shalom, you have no choice but to acquiesce. You had better forgive them. And what happens over here? Over here, I think that we can describe Moshe Rabbeinu's response as absolute despair. Moshe Rabbeinu is frightened of the burden and the responsibility, frightened, a fear and trembling unto death, and he says, Hargeini Naharo, kill me! What is this terrible thing that you've done? He complains so bitterly of his lot. Does he defend the people here as he defended them by the Egel? He doesn't defend them at all. He accuses them. He says these are a bunch of children. I have buzzer, I have meat, and I'm going to give them meat to eat. Where am I going to get buzzer from to give them buzzer? We've never heard Moshe in all of Torah speak as he speaks here. And our problem is, we don't understand Moshe, and maybe the reason why we don't understand Moshe is because we don't really understand the Jewish people. What's happening over here? What do you mean? They're crying for buzzer! For buzzer! And they remember the selective memory of all the great things. Mitzrayim was Gan Eden. You understand? Mitzrayim was Gan Eden on earth. When Moshe Rabbeinu says, and this fascinated me a bit, by Yom Moshe Hashem, in Pasuk 11, Moshe said to God, Lama hare'ota la'avdecha. By the way, for those of you who don't have Chumashim, most of the Pesukim that we're going to deal with are in footnote number 4. Lama hare'ota la'avdecha v'lama lo matzati chen beinecha. I want to ask you a question. When Moshe says, Lama hare'ota, does this bring anything else to mind? Is there any memory association? Anything clicking into place? What did you say? Say that again. Say that again. Lama hade'ota la'am hazeh. Where is that pasuk? That's the next question. The lady over there said that there's a pasuk in Torah where Moshe says to God, Lama hare'ota la'am hazeh. Over here, of course, Moshe is saying, Lama hare'ota li'avdecha, why were you so bad to your servant? There it says, Lama, huh? Lama zeh shalachtani, you got the second part of the pasuk. We're doing very well. We're doing very well. Now all we have to remember is, where is the pasuk and in what context is it being said?
After Moshe Rabbeinu spoke to Bnei Israel, Pharaoh.
Very good. Okay, we got the context. Now the place. The very end of Parsha Shmos. Did somebody say it there? Moshe comes to the for the first time, he comes before Paro, and he says, let my people go. And Paro's response is, oh, they're lazy, they're slackening off. From now on, there is a new edict. Up until that point, they were given the raw materials from which to make the bricks in order to build the pyramids. From now on, they're not going to be given the raw materials. They're going to have to go out and find the raw materials themselves, and they're going to have to keep up the amount of production as before, and the people are falling under the burden. So here Moshe Rabbeinu had come from Mitzrayim thinking that he's going to be the great redeemer of the Jewish people. And things get worse. Things get worse. Since he got there, things became worse. I just know it's the end of the end of the Shmos. Yeah. Yeah. Master of Shmos. By Yosef Moshe Hashem, Moshe returned to God by Yom, and he said, Hashem, Lama Hade Ota. Why have you been so bad to this people? Lama Zeshalachani, why did you send me? Umayos Bafi El Paro, from the time that I've come to Paro, Lazabi Yishmecha, to speak in your name. Heida Lama Hazeh. Things have gotten worse for this people. You didn't save your people. So God's response to Moshe is, now you're going to see. You know? When things get absolutely worse, then you know that they're going to have to become absolutely better. So just as I made this memory association and I looked at the two psukim, there's something that struck me. And I wondered about it. Hare'ota over there is spelled with a hey at the end. Lama hare'ota la'am hazeh. How is hare'ota spelled here? Without a hey at the end. Lama hare'ota. At the end of Parshat Shmos, it's written with a hey. And here it's written without a hey. Now that struck me. Of course, I only mention it because I think I have a good answer. I think I have a good answer. And it's something that I may have said a few years ago, but never on these two words. When the Jewish people have sinned with the Egel, so it says the day after Moshe had cleansed the camp of those who worshipped the Egel, it says that Moshe tells the Jewish people, I'm going up to God and I'm going to pray for forgiveness. And he stands before God and he says, Ona Levashim Chota Ha'am Hazer Chata Ogedolah. This people has sinned Chata Ogedolah, a great sin. What's a Chata'a? Isn't the word Chet? Ona, why doesn't he simply say, this people have sinned a great Chet? It says Chata'a with a hey at the end. Chata'a with a hey. What's the difference between a Chet and a Chata'a? Okay. At the end of Parashat Shoftim, in Sefer Devarim, there is the Parsha of Egla Arupa. An Egla Arupa is in the event that another somebody has been found dead on the road, and we don't know who is responsible, so the Sanhedrin have to come from Yerushalayim, and they have to measure off from the place where they found the body to the closest city, and the elders and the priests, the Kohanim of that city, have to take out a calf that has never worked with, and they have to bring it down to a valley and chop its head off. And they are supposed to say, Yodeinu lo shafchu et hadam hazeh. Our hands did not spill this blood. So the Gemara and Rashi brings it on the spot. Did it occur to us for a moment that the Sanhedrin of that city or the Bezin of that city, they are so ignorant, they spill blood? What are you talking about? Why do they have to say Yodeinu lo shafchu et hadam hazeh? We didn't spill this blood. So the Gemara explains it. So Rashi says, they have to be able to say that even in an indirect way, we are not guilty of this man's death. In other words, if this man would have come to our city and we would have seen him and known about him, and we wouldn't have provided him with a place where to sleep and a place where to eat, if we wouldn't have provided him with the necessities of life, and then he ends out on the road someplace out there and finds his death, then we carry that responsibility. Sanhedrin have to be able to say our hands did not spill this blood, either directly or indirectly, either by an act of commission, God forbid, or by omission, that we didn't do what we should have done. Shafchu, Yadenu, our hands, lo shafchu, is spelled in a way that shafchu is not spelled anyplace else. Shin, bei, chaf, hey. There's a hey at the end of shafchu. No place else is it spelled at it. And it's a strange hey, and it says you're supposed to read it as though there's no hey over there. I once said the following. There's a sin, and there's a sin Allah. There's a chet, and there's a chata'ah. The difference between a chet and a chata'ah is a chet is an act of commission. Somebody did something wrong. A chata'ah is indirect. Not a sin of commission, but a sin of omission. Because remember, when Moshe Rabbeinu was going up to the mountain, this is after the 3,000 who had worshipped the Egel have already been punished. So who's he asking forgiveness for? For the rest of Klal Yisrael who didn't worship the Egel? For what do they need forgiveness? They need forgiveness for having remained silent, for doing nothing. That's not a chet, that's a chata'ah. Just as when the elders of the city come out and say, Yodeinu lo shafchu et hadam hazeh, our hands did not spill this blood. We're not talking about spilling blood directly by killing. Shafchu with a hey at the end means we didn't spill all of this blood. There's something about we are not even indirectly involved in it. I have a feeling that might very well answer the two words that we're talking about now. When Moshe Rabbeinu comes and he says to God, Lama hare osa la'am hazeh, with a hey at the end, why have you done evil to this people? He doesn't mean that God has directly done evil, because God didn't do anything. And that's God's problem. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu is saying. Who is the one that made the slavery even greater? The act of intensifying the pain, the suffering, was Paro. But since God permitted it, his was a sin of omission. Lama hare ota. Why did you permit such evil to be done to this people? When Moshe Rabbeinu in this sedra stands before God and he says, Lama hare ota li avdecha, there's no hay at the end. Because he is the man where the buck stops. Moshe Rabbeinu is the one who is responsible for this people. And by having placed upon me such a burden, you have directly an act of commission. You have caused me great evil. I can't carry this people. That was just an aside to differentiate between if one place the Torah writes Haveyota with a hay, and here it writes Haveyota without a hay, it can be absolutely certain that there is good reason for it. And I think that we have succeeded. We have succeeded in answering that correctly. All right. But we're back to our more serious problem. More serious problem over here is, and by the way, that if you want to see that other pasuk, number 5, you can immediately, you can compare number 4 and number 5. In number 4 it says, Vayomer Moshe Hashem, that's the pasuk in this week, said, Lama Hadeota, without a hay at the end. And in pasuk 5, Lama Hadeota, La'am Hazeh, with a hay. So the question that we really ask right now is, why does Moshe Rabbeinu react so differently here? By Egel, powerful leadership, responds defiantly with strength. And over here, Moshe Rabbeinu is simply overwhelmed with despair, and he throws his hand up to the point where he says, Rabbeinu Shlilim, kill me. And furthermore, and maybe here is the root of the whole problem, what takes place over here, and the name of this place is going to be called Kivrot HaTa'ava. Because later on the pasuk is going to tell us that God is going to say, you want basar, you're going to get basar until it comes out of your, come out of your ears. And the slav, the quail begin coming down upon the camp, and the pasuk is very, it's very instructive over there. I'll read the psukim. Vayyosef Moshe l'amachnehu v'ziknei Yisrael, Pasuk Lamed in chapter, Pasuk 30 in chapter 11. Moshe went into the camp, and v'ruach nosa me'et Hashem, there was wind that journeyed from God. Vayogol salvin min hayam, slav, quail came flying in from the sea. Vayitosh al-amachneh, spread all over the camp, kederech yom ko, u'kederech yom ko, one day's journey this way, one day's journey that way. We are talking about a mass of fowl. Shvivot ha-machaneh, u'ka'amotayim al-gnei haris, and it was piled up high, it didn't fit, it's unbelievable. Vayokum ha'am kol ha-yom ha-hu v'chol ha-layla, the people got up that day and all of that night, v'chol yom ha-machros, and the entire other day, vayasuf, that's lovingly gathered the quails, ha-manis, of-sorach, of the one who got a little bit, brought back 10 big, I don't know what, 10 big meshes, by yishtechulahem shatoach, vivot ha-machmer, they spread them out all around the camp. Habot ha-odenu bein shineyem, the flesh was still between their teeth, terem yikarei, v'af Hashem, chora v'am, v'yach Hashem v'am, makor rabam yo. In the midst of their eating, they died. A great, great blow against the camp. V'yikra Hashem ha-makom ahu, they call that place Kivrot HaTa'ava. We've nearly forgotten that just a few days ago, these people were marching triumphantly toward Eretz Yisrael. What happened over there? Is this a people gone mad? What has happened to this people? And the fact is, if we're to compare Egel to what happens here, which is the worst Aveda? Egel was up on the Zora. Here they have a Tivus, that's a little flesh, you know, so, all right. It's not nice. But they were talking about idolatry. What are we talking about here? All right, but they wanted a little place. I don't know that the Gemeshim could have told them, listen, I know you want. So wait till you get into Eretz Yisrael. We're going to get there right away. And we'll make a barbecue. There's going to be a carbon pesach when they get into Eretz Yisrael. But that's the place. When one looks at it from the point of view of halacha, Egel was infinitely worse than Kibbutz HaTavah. So what do you want? It's a relatively minor infraction. There's no idolatry. There's no murder. There's no sexual immorality. So what's God getting so angry about? What is he getting so upset about? To the point that it says, "Vayichar af Hashem ma'od ubeinei Moshe ra." Terrible, terrible, what's going on over there? Says Rav Soloveitchik, says Rav Tzadik Barucha. We have to differentiate between idolatry and paganism. What's the difference between idolatry and paganism? Idolatry, avodah zarah, is the actual worship of an idol, performing the rituals that are, so to speak, required by that idol. There are all sorts of cultic performances that are done before the idol. And this is, Egel was not the only time that Jews worshipped an idol. We're going to have it at the Nebuchadnezzar at the end of Parshas Balak. There's going to be the Baal Peor incident, a terrible incident. What's paganism? Together with idolatry, there is what one would call a way of life. In contemporary terminology, it would be a lifestyle. Everybody got a lifestyle. And my lifestyle, signon hakayim. Look, paganism is which comes together with idolatry. In other words, idolatry is, say, call it the religion, call it the ideology, the theology. But every ideology and theology and every religion has with it also a lifestyle that is basic to and flows directly from that idolatry or from that ideology. Paganism is a cultural system. It's a manner of living. It's a way of conduct. It's a lifestyle. Now, avodah zarah, idolatry, inevitably leads to paganism. Yet, and here comes the most important thing of all. Even after idolatry may be overcome, even after idolatry may pass from the scene, paganism can remain. 1,000 years after Rome and Greece had already removed idolatry, they were still a bunch of pagans. The lifestyle to which they had become accustomed to, the lifestyle of lust and depravity of all sorts, continued. It's easier to undo idolatry than it is to eradicate paganism. Idolatry, it's possible to talk with somebody intellectually, theologically. I'm going to prove to you that this idol is nothing. I will prove to you that God, the God of heaven, is the greatest of all. There's somebody to talk to, and you can say something on the intellectual level. There's so much to talk about. We can talk about proofs of the existence of God. We can talk about proofs that idols are nonsense. I mean, all sorts of ideologies that have come and gone from the face of this earth, they last for a certain period of time, and then they crumble, except, of course, for the longest lasting of all time. But paganism is the lifestyle that is engendered and created by idolatry. To get rid of that, it requires a great deal more than a rebbe or a teacher. It's going to require a great deal more than proofs of the existence of God or the non-existence of idols. Paganism was the result of the fact that people worshipped deities that represented forces in nature, and what they therefore sanctified and made holy, nature became holy. And if nature is holy, then it means anything that is part of natural man is holy. And if man therefore has lust, and he has desires and passions, that's also holy. The deities of the idol worshiping world were deities without moral norms. They never made demands on man. There were certain acts of propitiation, in other words, in order to find favor in the eyes of the deity, but they never made any kind of demands. If anything, what they encouraged, what ancient idolatry encouraged, was to partake of nature with lust. And in identifying with these idols, man sees himself as part of nature. And as part of nature, man acts with absolute abandon. What idolatry permitted was unlimited indulgence. All that's possible is permissible, or in our contemporary terminology, anything that's enjoyable is therefore, ipso facto, permissible. Idolatry, which led to paganism, meant to acknowledge no restraints in the human appetite. Do whatever you want. Judaism, on the other, said that man is created in the divine image. He's not a child of nature. There's a neshama in the human being that makes him holy, and therefore he must exercise self-control. There must be a subordination of craving. God has to be worshipped and not nature. And Torah therefore called upon the Jewish people that there are do's and don'ts. There have to be restraints. Man has to know to control his passions. At Kibbutz Hatava, do you know what's being, you know what's happening over here? Idolatry may have ended with the Egel, but the residue, the lifestyle, the paganism remains. And what they ask for now, Mi Achilenu Basar, who's going to give us flesh? So the fact is, Rashi brings Chazal that says that then when they cried L'mishpachoteim, according to their families, Rashi says they cried Al Itzkei Mishpachos, about families, because at Sinai they were prohibited all sorts of marriages, and marriages within the family were prohibited. A sister, an aunt, all of this was... When I made that slip before, and I'm not calling it a Freudian one, when I made that slip before and I said, who will give us flesh? And what I meant was flesh. What they were really talking about is not only the flesh of animals, but it represents the idea of the appetite and the lust for all flesh. That's what they really wanted. And when Moshe is faced with this, Moshe sees himself as the great Rebbe of Klal Yisrael. Now Moshe Rabbeinu is going to have to undertake a completely new role. And for this role, he's unprepared. The Rebbe is the teacher, the man of intellect, the Talmud Chacham, the one who's going to prove to them the existence of God, the one who's going to tell them that idolatry is nonsense. But now he's dealing with the people who are still living with the paganism, the lust of their previous life, which was only a year ago. Here he's going to have to deal with them like an omein. An omein means like a mother, a nursing mother. This is not intellectual, this is completely emotional. He's going to have to surrender himself completely to them. He's going to have to raise them. This is no longer an intellectual undertaking. This is not what Moshe Rabbeinu sees himself prepared for. Can you even see the difference? We had just described how the people, how they go out to gather in the Slav. The description is of people running amok and wild, grabbing, piling up, and people who got a great deal and others didn't get as much. In Parashat Bishalach, there's a description of how Jews went out to gather in the mon. The gathering in the mon, Jews learned very quickly, it made absolutely no difference how hard you worked. Hamar beth hamamit, the one who gathered a lot and the one who gathered a little, came home with precisely the same amount. And on the contrary, the description over there is a leisurely going through the camp to bring home the food. It's not the description of the wanton lust that we have over here. I'll tell you, does paganism exist? Does paganism exist in our midst? So of all things, I don't know, I'm forever trying to organize the papers in my house. I even try to throw stuff out. Very rarely do I succeed. But I came across an article that I had read some years ago, and I knew that someday I'm going to need this article. Dennis Prager wrote a special report, a 24-page report, and this is amazing. He studied homosexuality. He makes a number of comments I'm going to read. Two of the things that are so powerful, so poignant. Man's nature, undisciplined by values, will allow passion to dominate his life and the life of society. When Judaism demanded that all sexual activity be channeled into marriage, it changed the world. Then Judaism changed the world. It is not overstated to say that the Torah's prohibition of non-marital sex made the creation of Western civilization possible. Societies that did not place boundaries upon passion were stymied in their development. They never developed. The subsequent dominance of the Western world can, to a significant extent, be attributed to the sexual revolution initiated by Judaism and later carried forward by Christianity. It is probably impossible for us who live thousands of years after Judaism began this process to perceive the extent to which passion, sexual passion, can dominate and has dominated life. Now there's a major study here of ancient civilizations and countries throughout the world on Hayom Hazeh. One thing he makes quite clear, I mean, this you have to know, if anybody thinks sort of that homosexuals are coming out of the closet today, and this is being used as an example, this is nonsense. Homosexuality was prevalent throughout the world, in every country of the world until this century, and even in this century in most places of the world. It's not a new lifestyle. It's the most ancient lifestyle of all. And for that reason, in great measure, women were no more than chattel and slaves in the ancient world, because they were not part of man's world. Man's real world was not the heterosexual world. And this was true throughout all over the world. It's still true in a major part of the world today. Judaism placed controls on sexual activity. It could no longer dominate religion and social life. It was to be sanctified, which in Hebrew means separated from the world and placed in the home, husband and wife. Judaism restricting of sexual behavior was one of the essential elements that enabled society to progress. Along with ethical monotheism, the belief in one God, and a value system, the revolution begun by the Torah when it declared war on the sexual practices of the world wrought the most far-reaching changes in history. Describing a world that, for all intents and purposes, permitted all sorts of terrible activity, the one continuous exception was Jewish civilization, and 1,000 years later, Christian civilization. Other than the Jews, none of the archaic civilizations prohibited homosexuality. It was Judaism alone that about 3,000 years ago declared homosexuality wrong. And it said some of the most powerful and unambiguous language it could. It is very fascinating, Sanders. He says, it is Judaism's sexual values, not homosexuality, that historically has been deviant. Torah has been the deviant. Because Torah entered into a world that gave vent to all of its passions and said, no, I've come. There have to be limitations. There has to be responsibility. You can't do whatever you want. You understand what Kibrot HaTaiva is? Kibrot HaTaiva is the paganism that results from idolatry. Anything, as long as it's pleasurable and I want to do it, it's good. And Torah stood up there and said, no. And it's only the result of the fact that Torah said no, that Western civilization was able to develop. Because there were limitations. Do you know what Judaism created? You know what Torah created? The family. There would not have been a family unit as we know it today without Torah. Further, he's going to have just another few comments over here. And I'm not going to go into all of the gory details he cites a whole world, certainly everything, every civilization on the face of this earth where homosexuality was practiced. I'm afraid to say it, there's one big footnote over here where he describes, it can be a great danger to my life, one of the great homosexuals of our time, Yasser Arafat, Yimach Shemai, and he documents it, but that's it. I don't want anybody on the other side, to hear what we're saying. But watch. That's not what's important over here. What I really want to get at is, when a conservative and reform movement, you understand, come out on behalf of the rights of all deviants, this is not a new lifestyle. They're talking about permitting something or giving legitimacy to something which Torah sought to destroy for all time, and only through Torah's opposition to it was Western civilization able to grow. In the Hebrew Bible, in particular the Torah, has done more. Dennis Prager is not a comedian. But listen, the Hebrew Bible has done more to civilize the world than any other book or idea in history. It is the Hebrew Bible that gave humanity such ideas as a universal, moral, loving God, ethical obligations to this God, the need for history to move forward to moral and spiritual redemption, the belief that history has meaning, and the notion that human freedom and social justice are the divinely desired states for all people. It gave the world the Ten Commandments, ethical monotheism, and the concept of holiness, the goal of raising human beings from the animal-like to the godlike. That's really Moshe's challenge now. He has to take a people that have now shown themselves to be animal-like and take these people and turn them into Mamlechet Kohanim V'Goy Kadosh, a kingdom of priests and a holy people. Prager goes on to say, therefore, this Bible that has given the world all of these great values, when this Bible makes strong moral proclamations, I listen with great respect. And regarding male homosexuality, this Bible speaks in such clear and direct language that one does not have to be a religious fundamentalist in order to be influenced by its views. All that is necessary is to consider oneself a Syrian Jew or Christian. However, few Jews need to be informed of the centrality of the family to Jewish life. Throughout their history, one of the Jews' most distinguishing characteristics has been their commitment to family life. To Judaism, the family, not the nation and not the individual, is to be the fundamental unit, the building block of society. Thus, when God blesses Abraham, he says, through you all the families of the earth will be blessed. So, basic to establishing the Jewish family was, of course, the idea that homosexuality is prohibited. I think one more quote from toward the very end, because I can keep going on and on and on. He has a lot of tremendous things that he says over here. I don't know, I'll have to find that. Okay. His epilogue, the end of the end. Doing the research for this piece, the longest writing and research I have ever done for anything but the two books I co-authored, turned out to be a religious experience for me. Every so often in my life, I re-realized just how world-changing Judaism was when it first came into the world. To a world in which every nation believed in multiple gods who were little more and often considerably less than supermen and superwomen, Judaism said, "You are wrong." To a world that divided human sexuality between penetrator and penetrated, Judaism said, "You are wrong. Sexuality is to be divided between male and female." to a world which saw women as baby producers unworthy of romantic and sexual attention, Judaism said you are wrong. Women must be the sole focus of men's love. To a world which said that sensual feelings and physical beauty were life's supreme values, Judaism said you are wrong. Ethics and holiness are the supreme values. 1,000 years before Roman emperors kept naked boys, Jewish kings were commanded to write and keep a Sefer Torah, a book of the Torah. In all my research, nothing more moved me than the Talmudic law that Jews were forbidden to sell slaves or sheep to non-Jews, lest the non-Jews engage in homosexuality and bestiality. I was asked, I was asked what the single greatest revelation I derived from all of this whole study. I responded that there had to have been divine revelation to produce the Torah. The Torah was simply too different from the rest of the world, too against man's nature, to have been solely man-made. Beautiful. Judaism was radical. Judaism was revolutionary. Not today, those who want to go back to a pagan way of life and give legitimacy to it. What they're giving legitimacy to is Kibrot HaKava. What they don't understand with all of their liberal open-mindedness, that all that they're doing is they're taking us back 4,000 years. The revolution which Torah began, and the way in which it was so different from the rest of the world, that it could only have been given by a God, it couldn't have been given by man, was the idea that man is holy, he has an neshama in him, and therefore in order to rise to greatness, there have to be controls and limitations, and man has to sanctify himself. That's what it was all about. And when Moshe is faced over here with Kibrot HaTava, Moshe doesn't know how to deal with it. He can deal with idolatry, he can deal with Abel as well. He can't deal with paganism. He can't deal with these passions because this is going to be something that's going to require of him a completely different form of leadership. His leadership of Klal Yisrael is going to no longer be now only Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe our teacher. You know what he's going to be? He's going to have to be Kasher Yisrael HaOmein et HaYonet. That's what he says. Like the Omein carries the child. What's an Omein? Huh? A nurse. Where do we have the word Omein? We have it by Mordechai and Esther. By he Omein es Hadassah, he Esther. I have a feeling that the word Omein comes from the word Omein or Emunah, which means faith and trust. There is the intellectual teacher, that's the Rebbe. All you have to do is, you know, believe him or respect him. An Omein is one who merges completely with the child, and the personalities become one, and the child has complete trust, an absolute trust of the one who is taking care of him. Moshe Rabbeinu, the Rav, says that Moshe Rabbeinu here sees that his role is going to have to change completely, and in that changed role, he's going to have to become full-time devoted to Klal Yisrael to the extent that all of his individuality, his own family life, everything is going to have to be set aside for the greater task of taking this people and forging them into a holy nation. It's not going to be as simple as he thought it was going to be, because he's not going to have to deal with idolatry alone. That he can deal with, but he's going to have to deal with paganism. And with paganism, where there is the lust and the craving, and this is what stands in their way. They're going to have to be, they don't know each other, but they're going to have to spend 40 years in the desert preparing themselves for the entry into Eretz Yisrael. The entry into Eretz Yisrael is not going to be able to be fulfilled by a people whose tava, whose lust and passions and desires, and they have been taught all the time that this is the way man is supposed to conduct himself. So that the tragedy over here is because of the state in which the people find themselves. And by the way, it's not a matter of passing judgment on them.
the Dulles Mitzrayim, just like every other exile, has left us with a residue of all sorts of negative ideas and feelings and manners of conduct, and it takes a long, long time until that is that's done. So that Moshe Rabbeinu, by the Egel Azog, he's able to stand up with great confidence without despair, because he reacted as a teacher, forceful pronouncements. He shatters the luchos, but by Kiras HaTaiva, he's dealing with a completely different challenge. Not idolatry, but paganism, unlimited lust, wantonness, boundless desire. So now the Rebbe now has to become the Omein, and Moshe Rabbeinu is not certain that he is going to be able to serve that function. But ultimately, I have a feeling that maybe the end of the Sedra already tells us of the changed role of Moshe, because it says that Miriam speaks to Aaron about Moshe. What is it that she says to Aaron about Moshe? She finds out that Moshe has separated from his wife Tzipora, and Miriam doesn't understand. Why does he have to do this? I have a feeling, in a sense, maybe Miriam is unaware of the changed role of Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu is going to have to take this slave people, and we're talking about a people who are enslaved to passions and wants, and he's going to have to forge them and form them into this Mamlechet Kohanim, the Goy Kadosh, which is going to be a far, far more difficult task than he had ever imagined. And in fact, it is paganism that we are waging war against Ar HaYom HaZeh. So therefore, when you're going to hear all of these great pronouncements by all sorts of so-called spiritual leaders, you should know that what they are speaking about is to give legitimacy to paganism, that which Torah fought against, and the great contribution of Torah was to remove paganism in great measure from the world, or at least create one people who are not pagans, and are the Mamlechet Kohanim. Okay, that's it.